How to survive a voyage with Blackbeard. Let's say you want to join up with a bold group of entrepreneurs pursuing a lucrative opportunity in international trade. You want to take an equal partnership alongside a skilled team of equally dedicated founders chasing life-changing payouts, and you don't mind a bit of adventure or a bit of risk. So you travel back to the city of Nassau on the Bahamian island of New Providence in the year 1717. It's the height of piracy's golden age, back when pirate crews operated out of their own capital city, stole some of the most lucrative treasures in the history of criminal enterprise with firepower rivaling that of the European navies, and grew so powerful that they brought Atlantic sea trade to a near standstill. But you don't want to work with just any pirate captain. You want to sail with the best. You want to sail alongside the most famous and most feared pirate of all time. So you arrive in Nassau on September 29, 1717, to join up with a certain black-bearded, Bristol-born pirate named Edward Thatch, just as he assumes command of the Revenge and sails out of Nassau port. Over the next month, Thatch unleashes the most devastating pirate assault the British colonies have ever witnessed. In just 2 weeks, he captures 15 merchant ships as they approach ports in Delaware, Philadelphia, New York, and the Chesapeake. He plunders their cargo and recruits so many of their crewmen to turn pirate that he adds another ship to his pirate fleet. But those who don't turn to his side, he sends on their way because, despite Thatch's bravado and fearsome reputation, he has a secret. He's unusually hospitable to those he captures. Footnote: remarkably, over Thatch's entire career, there is not a single documented case of him ever having killed anyone until his final battle. Over the fall of 1717, hijacked seafarers pour into the sea towns of Europe and the Americas, telling tales of a tall, slim pirate with a long black beard, a bandolier of pistols, and a face obscured by fire, a result of fuses he lit and tucked under his cap. According to one account, imagination cannot form an idea of a fury from hell to look more frightful. In just 1 month after assuming command, the pirate Captain Edward Thatch has become the pirate legend, Blackbeard. Over the next 15 months, Blackbeard will terrorize the shipping lanes of the Atlantic, the Gulf of Mexico, and the Caribbean. He will rob more than 100 ships, siege the city of Charleston, and at his height, command a pirate fleet so formidable that ships of the Royal Navy itself flee at mere rumors of his presence. Then, just over a year after taking command, he'll be killed in a bloody sea battle. But you can survive. You can commit some of the most lucrative heists in criminal history and live to spend the riches. But before you survive the bloody sea battles, you'll need to learn how to survive the greatest threat of all, your fellow pirates. You'll need to learn the rules because you're not joining an anarchic group of nihilists. This sophisticated criminal enterprise might seem like a floating anarchy from the outside, but because these seemingly lawless rebels cannot count on the authorities to fairly adjudicate transgressions, they have to rely on their own codes and their own punishments to keep disagreements at bay and rule breakers in line. The result is that, like most organized crime syndicates, these supposed rebels operate under a far more prescriptive set of behavioral boundaries than the outside worlds. Unfortunately, the rules specific to Blackbeard's boats have never been found, but we do have at least some idea of what you can expect, because the rules to the contemporary pirate Captain Bartholomew Black Bart Roberts' ship have survived. These rules are as follows. Bedtime below deck is at 8 p.m. sharp. There shall be no noise below deck after that hour, no fighting on board. Any disagreements will be resolved on the beach with pistol and sword. No gambling, period. No desertion, and of course, no stealing from the ship. There are no women allowed on board either. Plus, there's an oddly specific rule against disguising a woman as a man on board, the punishment for which is the default, death, though how that is meted out varies. Walking the plank is a Hollywood invention, but marooning is not. If you sail with Blackbeard expecting an anything goes, it's a pirate's life for me, free for all, you'll waste away on a deserted island with a single pistol shot as your only salvation. You also need to know how to speak like a pirate. English was the lingua franca among the multicultural crew, who originated from across Europe, Africa, and the Caribbean. The majority, though, were born in England or its colonies. Surprisingly, Hollywood's pirate accent, "Arr, matey," etc., is an exaggerated approximation of the truth. It's a form of the Cornwall accent, which is the coastal county on England's southwestern tip where many pirates were born, so drop your H's and roll your R's. Fortunately, even if your fake Cornish accent turns a few heads, because piracy is an extraordinarily diverse enterprise, your awkward R's may not get you killed as quickly as you might think. The same can sadly not be said for the viruses and bacteria you'll find aboard. You're not only sharing tight quarters with hundreds of unwashed sea dogs, you're eating rotting food, drinking contaminated water, and traveling to foreign lands rife with foreign ailments. It would be difficult to construct an unhealthier environment than the hull of a pirate ship. Here, disease will kill you as quickly as any cannonball. Pirate ships typically carry doctors, but if you should sicken, don't see one. At best, their medical care will be ineffective. At worst, you might receive something like the urethral injection of mercury that divers discovered on Blackbeard's wrecked Queen Anne's Revenge, which pirates used to treat syphilis. Decline that prescription. Try to eat fresh food, particularly if it's meat, and avoid water entirely. Drink the grog instead. It's a rum-water mixture of various dilutions, as essential as sails to 18th-century ships. If you can follow the rules and dodge dysentery and disease, you should at least survive the first few months, because the first merchant vessels that Blackbeard attacked were no match for his armada. After a month spent terrorizing the North American coast, Blackbeard departed the North Atlantic's rough winter seas for the calmer Caribbean. He patrolled the narrow shipping lanes of the Middle Passage, hunting for ships carrying enslaved Africans to the Americas. Pirates prized these infamous slavers not for their cargo, but for the ships themselves. Unlike the open holds of their merchant vessel ships, a slave ship's multi-decked structure could house both large pirate crews and enough cannons to rival anything in the Royal Navy. On November 17, 1717, after only 2 days lying in wait, Blackbeard spotted the huge sails of the French slave ship La Concorde and maneuvered his fleet upwind of his prey. In 18th-century sea battles, a ship holding the upwind position on its opponent, called holding the weather gauge, provided several decisive advantages. First, ships running upwind heel from the sidewise pressure of the wind, while ships running downwind stay level. The difference mattered in an exchange of cannon fire because the aim of 2-ton guns could not be adjusted quickly or easily. In an exchange of broadsides, the ship holding the weather gauge fired directly into the opponent while their enemy's cannonballs sailed overhead. Second, while even modern sailboats cannot sail directly into the wind, warships in piracy's golden age couldn't move into the entire third of the upwind sky. As a result, a ship upwind of its opponent would have almost complete freedom of movement, while its opponents would be pinned and predictable. This freedom allowed the upwind ship to perform a particularly devastating maneuver that naval strategists call crossing the T, wherein the attacking ship cut across the path of its oncoming enemy. Because 17th-century warships had few or no cannon in the front or rear, the passing ship could unleash a full broadside without risk of return fire. A particularly skilled captain, such as Blackbeard, would veer within feet of his downwind opponent and fire cannonballs down the entire length of the ship. Yet, for pirates like Blackbeard, a broadside was a method of last resort. Broadsides risked sinking or damaging treasure. Instead, a pirate's preference was to engage the enemy in hand-to-hand combat, where sheer numbers gave them an overwhelming advantage. Blackbeard's ship carried as many as 300 sailors, while merchant vessels rarely held more than a few dozen. Using hooks, ropes, and ladders, pirates could lash the two boats together and swarm their victim in an overwhelming assault. Of course, if a good pirate won sea battles, a great pirate avoided them entirely. Battles risked injury, death, damage to boats, or worst of all, the treasure itself. So a great pirate cultivated an aura of bloodthirsty craziness, but combined it with a reputation for mercy if the enemy surrendered. To help coax surrender, pirates signaled their bloody intentions with gruesome flags of blood, skull, and bone. They gathered on deck, waved their swords and guns, yelled threats, even wafted smoke about their faces, anything to convey their seriousness to do battle so that they wouldn't have to. Usually, it worked. Faced with the overwhelming force of a pirate crew while protecting cargo that was not their own, most merchant ships tried to flee, but when cornered, few fought. On November 17th, the captain of La Concorde tries to escape, but when it becomes clear he will be overtaken, he turns his vessel into the wind and raises a white flag. True to his reputation, Blackbeard takes the ship, but gives the crew of La Concorde one of your smaller sloops, which they rename Bad Encounter, and sends them on their way. Meanwhile, Blackbeard refits La Concorde with 40 cannons, crews it with 300 pirates, and renames it Queen Anne's Revenge. Footnote: they chose this name for political reasons. Most pirates were so-called Jacobites who believed that after Queen Anne's death, her house, the House of Stuart, was the rightful ruler of England and thus supported her half-brother James's claim to the throne. But because James was a Catholic and Catholics had been excluded by an act of Parliament, Anne's second cousin, George I, House of Hanover, ruled instead. With QAR as his flagship, Blackbeard not only commands one of the most fearsome fleets in the Americas, he establishes one of the most powerful criminal operations in world history. Piracy has plagued the open seas for as long as ships have traversed them, but the rise of its golden age began when an English naval policy that leaned heavily upon military contractors backfired spectacularly. When war broke out against Spain in 1654, England outsourced its military efforts by encouraging private citizens to legally pirate Spanish merchant ships. Under letters of marque, these legal pirates, called privateers, could lawfully keep a share of what they stole. Business was good. In 1671, the privateer Captain Henry Morgan and his fleet of 37 ships and 2,000 privateers sacked the Spanish city of Panama and stole hundreds of thousands of pesos. King Charles II rewarded his efforts with the governorship of Jamaica. During the War of the Spanish Succession from 1701 to 1714, England expanded its usage of privateers, legalizing at least 1,400 ships to attack Spanish ships across the globe. When the war finally ended, England halted privateering, but rediscovered the cost of outsourcing military efforts. After encouraging thousands of private citizens to pursue lucrative careers in piracy, the country asked these skilled buccaneers to return to poorly paid ones. Not all of them did. The alternative for privateers was a brutal, brief, and poorly paid career as a merchant sailor. These sailors worked long hours for captains who often cut their rations, docked their pay, whipped them with the infamous cat-o'-nine-tails, and sometimes even killed them without repercussion. Combine this with the dangers of disease inherent in life at sea, and merchant sailors often never lived long enough to spend their meager wage of £25 per year, $4,000 today. In contrast, a pirate could amass extraordinary wealth. On September 7, 1695, the pirate Henry Every captured more than £600,000, $100 million today, worth of gold and jewels from a convoy of ships in the Indian Ocean. In a single day, each member of his crew received more than they could hope to earn in a career as a merchant sailor. In April 1721, the pirate John Taylor captured the Portuguese treasure ship Nossa Senhora do Cabo off the coast of Reunion Island. His crew made off with more than £1 million sterling, the equivalent of $160 million today. Each pirate on Taylor's ships took home approximately £4,000, more than $500,000 today. And when a storm sank the pirate Captain Sam Bellamy's Wida off Cape Cod, it went down with more than 4 tons of gold and silver. But gold wasn't the only reason for a sailor to choose piracy. Almost every facet of life aboard a pirate ship was more comfortable and more equitable than serving aboard a merchant vessel. Whereas merchant seamen often suffered under tyrannical captains, pirate ships operated as surprisingly democratic and even progressive institutions. Almost a century before the French stormed the Bastille, pirate crews voted on their captains and placed a series of checks and balances on their power. Pirates elected a quartermaster to make all decisions regarding rations and punishments, and they voted on both where to sail and who to attack. Only during battle, which required snap decisions, could a captain rule unilaterally. Pirate captains slept in the same circumstances as the crew and received only a double share of the loot. When I asked Marcus Rediker, professor of Atlantic history at the University of Pittsburgh and author of Villains of All Nations, why these groups of cutthroats established proto-democracies, he tells me it was in part a response to horrific abuses of their previous lives. The democratic nature of the pirate way of life was formed as a reaction against the top-down, violent, authoritarian nature of rule on naval and merchant ships, he explains. Many pirates were former merchant sailors who had mutinied against their authoritative, abusive, and violent captains. They had no interest in exchanging one tyrant for another. Instead, they turned pirate in large part because they believed in what Rediker writes was a sailor's oppositional culture, equality, collectivism, and anti-authoritarianism. According to Rediker, these same values which had animated their mutinies guided the development of their floating societies. But there may be an additional explanation for piracy's curiously democratic governing structure, according to George Mason University behavioral economist Peter Leeson: greed. According to Leeson, merchant vessels were particularly tyrannical because they suffered from the common business conundrum known as the principal-agent problem, where those who do the work don't profit while those who profit don't do the work. Shipping merchants solved this problem by hiring tyrannical captains and including them in a share of the profit. These captains then had an incentive to both keep costs down and keep these otherwise poorly incentivized sailors working, which they did with a liberal use of corporal punishment. But pirate ships were employee-owned and operated. They didn't suffer from the principal-agent problem. They did the work and shared in the profits. Thus, they were already incentivized and had no use for tyrannical hierarchies. Like equal partners in a law firm, the pirate ship was a joint venture agreement between all parties who all shared in the proceeds and all had an equal say in the direction of the operation, like a cross between a drug cartel and Goldman Sachs. And yet, curiously, unlike a drug cartel, piracy didn't devolve into a violent, highly hierarchical structure. When I ask Leeson why, he explains it's the result of the different startup costs of each criminal business. A criminal enterprise that is cheap and easy to start, like drug dealing or the mafia's protection rackets, would, in a free market, face extremely stiff competition. If any bully with a gun is a potential competitor, startup goons will undercut the market until no profit remains. The only way these criminal rackets can stay in business is to create illegal monopolies with violently enforced collusion agreements. Piracy, however, required enormous startup costs. A successful pirate needed a large ship, hundreds of pirates, guns, and food for the crew. These costs kept the business relatively uncompetitive, which negated the need to remove competitors with violence. In this case, market forces rather than morality dictated moral choices. They also seem to have promoted a far more progressive racial composition than many of the era's other businesses. Black pirates comprised around a third of all scallywags, and most received the same compensation and voting rights as white pirates. One of Blackbeard's closest lieutenants was a legendarily burly former African chieftain named Caesar. This is not to suggest that pirates were abolitionists. In fact, they certainly weren't. Many pirates had previously enslaved people, worked on slave ships, and allowed the captains of the slave ships they hijacked to continue on to their ports with enslaved people still on board. Nevertheless, witness testimony from prisoners on pirate ships suggests at least some, or perhaps most, black pirates lived as free men with equal voting rights aboard pirate ships. This, too, can probably be explained by a pirate's financial incentives rather than moral scruples. With 300 men on a ship that could be run by a dozen, there wasn't much need for manual labor and thus little incentive to enslave. On top of that, anyone working against their will represented a flight risk who might testify against the pirates in court. So, despite what we can only assume were a pirate's evil intentions, neither enslavement nor conscription made any rational sense. Unlike the Royal Navy, which employed press gangs to roam the streets of London with clubs and handcuffs, beating, cuffing, and pressing any poor devil who looked like sailor material into naval service, pirates rarely conscripted, and only did so when the sailor possessed a rare and critical skill, such as doctors or gunsmiths. You are not among men of great morality, but you are among a crew whose past, greed, and aversion to risk dictate a surprisingly progressive code of conduct, perhaps in spite of their best intentions. On June 10, 1718, near the peak of Blackbeard's power and just after you siege the entire city of Charleston, South Carolina, Queen Anne's Revenge runs aground off the coast of North Carolina and the crew scatters. Blackbeard takes a small group of loyalists to meet with the governor of North Carolina, where he graciously accepts the king's pardon and then continues pirating and paying off the governor with his stolen loot. He makes his base off the North Carolina coast on Ocracoke Island, under what he believes is the governor's protection, and patrols the shipping lanes west of Bermuda. You need to take this opportunity to say your goodbyes and depart because, unlike in the early days of his piracy, the economies of the Americas have begun to change. No longer do these economic backwaters produce rounding errors for the great European powers. Instead, as the 18th century entered maturity, these once small economies began to drive obscene accumulations of wealth and power. And while this might seem to make piracy all the more lucrative, instead, it doomed the entire profession. Piracy has always flourished when the cost of its existence is lower than the cost of eradicating it. And in the Atlantic, the emergence of a new means to farm an old crop had begun to change that calculation. On May 14, 1625, John Powell captained the first English ship to disembark on the Caribbean island of Barbados. By then, European diseases and more than 100 years of Spanish slave raiding had wiped out the native population, so when Powell arrived, the island was almost completely uninhabited. English settlers established tobacco plantations and worked them with indentured English labor, but Barbados's small farms could hardly compete with the enormous tobacco fields in what is now the southern United States. As a result, its farms were only mildly profitable and its land cheap. In 1640, a farmer could purchase 500 acres of Barbados farmland for only 400 English pounds. Then came sugar. Human cultures have harvested sugarcane for at least 10,000 years, but the process required such a Herculean amount of labor it remained a luxury good as late as the mid-17th century. For cane to grow, a farmer must clear, dig, and hoe the land, place each cane in a deep hand-dug hole, then fertilize the fields with handfuls of stinking dung. Fertilizer supercharges the growth of the cane, but also the weeds, which along with the cane-eating rats, the farmer must exterminate regularly. Finally, when the plant ripens in the spring, the farmer must chop the thick stalk at its base, juice it, and then immediately boil the liquid before it spoils. Because of spoilage, sugar plantations are both farm and factory. There is no time to ship the cane off-site, and crops must be processed so quickly that during the months-long harvest season, production runs 24 hours a day. In the 17th century, workers in these plantations had to cut, press, boil, process, and dry the cane while operating heavy, dangerous equipment for long shifts in hellish heat. In other words, sugar was an extraordinarily labor-intensive, inefficient, lethal, and thus expensive good to produce, which limited its market to the very, very rich. That changed when the price of labor became very, very cheap. In 1645, approximately 11,000 white English farmers and some 6,000 enslaved people farmed tobacco on the economically struggling island of Barbados. But in the 1640s, Dutch traders from Brazil introduced sugarcane. This white gold, powered by the enslaved people who produced it, transformed the island. The crop showered wealth on landholders. By 1660, Barbados produced more wealth than all of England's American colonies combined. In just 10 years, the price of 500 acres on Barbados rose from 400 pounds to 7,000 pounds. Meanwhile, the demand for labor became insatiable. In just 15 years, the population of the island grew from 17,000 to 53,000 people, more than half of whom were enslaved African laborers. By 1667, Barbados's wealthiest landowners consolidated their holdings. Impoverished white descendants of the early indentured English laborers and prisoners fled, some to piracy, but most to the mainland, so that by 1770, 40,000 enslaved Africans labored on sugar plantations controlled by just 750 white English owners. Sugar became the most lucrative product, crossing the Atlantic, and sugar plantations quickly dominated the Caribbean. By 1714, the larger island of Jamaica outproduced Barbados. That year also marked the end to the War of the Spanish Succession, the treaty of which allowed Britain to greatly expand the number of enslaved people it could ship from Africa to the Americas. Piracy threatened this lucrative business. During the height of their golden age, pirates so thoroughly ravaged the ships crossing the Atlantic that they nearly severed the sugar and slave trade entirely. Between 1720 and 1722, as piracy reached a crescendo, the number of enslaved Africans shipped across the Atlantic dropped by half. In 1721, the governor of Antigua wrote to King George I that if piracy wasn't eliminated, all of the English plantations in America will be totally ruined in a very short time. England responded with increasing urgency. In 1718, the crown issued pardons to any pirate who ceased piracy. Many pirates, including Blackbeard, gladly accepted this pardon and then continued pirating. So in 1721, Parliament withdrew the carrot and offered the stick. It passed the Piracy Act, which sentenced pirate sympathizers or business partners to death by hanging, threatened to imprison any merchant sailor who declined to defend their ship, and declared that Navy captains could no longer conveniently avoid confrontations with powerful pirate fleets. Finally, in 1722, in response to increasing pressure from slave traders, the British Admiralty sent ships of war to the west coast of Africa, where the pirate captain Black Bart had captured more than 400 ships over the previous 3 years and nearly single-handedly severed the Middle Passage. On February 10, 1722, the Armada snuck up on Black Bart as he anchored off Gabon on the west coast of Africa, blasted the pirate captain with a broadside, and unofficially ended piracy's golden age. By 1725, with piracy in the Atlantic essentially eradicated, the yearly number of enslaved Africans shipped across the Middle Passage had doubled to more than 47,000. The rise of the slave trade and the increasingly obscene amount of wealth shipped across the Atlantic paradoxically spells the end for piracy's golden age, and that's when you need to depart Blackbeard's company. To safely continue piracy, you need to leave this part of the world. So, in the summer of 1718, catch a ride to the pirate-controlled island of Madagascar and join up with the pirate Captain John Taylor. Help him prowl the wealth passing through the Indian Ocean and capture the Nossa Senhora do Cabo, the most valuable heist in pirate history. Collect your share of the $160 million of diamonds, gold, and jewels and safely hide away on Madagascar or another Spanish-controlled isle. Plundering the Nossa Senhora isn't without risks. The Portuguese carry quite a grudge, but like Taylor, you should be able to purchase a pardon from a sympathetic Spanish court, and it's a far better option than continuing to ply the American coast with Blackbeard, where business interests have compelled the authorities to act. In the fall of 1718, the governor of Virginia ordered Royal Navy Lieutenant Robert Maynard, 60 soldiers, and 2 sloops to capture or kill the bearded pirate operating with impunity off the coast of North Carolina. On the morning of November 22, 1718, Maynard and his sloops entered the Ocracoke Island harbor, where Blackbeard and his skeleton crew of 20 men lay at anchor. As the boats neared, Blackbeard recognized the attack. He ordered his men to cannon and tried to make his escape. He sailed for the mouth of the bay and the open sea, and as he passed Maynard, he drank damnation to me and my men, saying he would neither give nor take quarter, according to a letter Maynard later wrote. Maynard may have had the advantage in numbers, but in order to traverse the shallow waters, he attacked with light ships lacking cannon. The decision nearly cost him his life. When Maynard attempted to pull up alongside the pirates, Blackbeard blasted broadsides into the impotent sloops, filling their decks with bodies and blood, killing Maynard's second-in-command, and disabling one of his ships. The blasts would have saved the pirates, Maynard later wrote, were it not for a lucky musket shot that severed Blackbeard's jib and forecastle, allowing Maynard to catch up to the escaping pirates. In the ensuing battle, Blackbeard fell to 5 pistol shots. The rest of his crew was either killed or captured and hung. Fortunately, you will have already departed. You'll be retired and sipping a grog cocktail on a Madagascar beach, or maybe you'll have started a venture fund investing in other pirate entrepreneurs seeking lucrative opportunities in international trade. Call it adventure capital.